Welcome to this episode of the Photonic Podcast with me, Jeremy, public member of the Photonic team, Angus Ramsey, the lead investigator, and today's guest, Patrick Hunter of the London Ambulance Service Trust. Photonic is a research study funded by the National Institute for Health and Social Care Research to look at pre-hospital video triage, a new way to check whether patients are having a stroke. The Photonic team are looking at how pre-hospital video triage services are put into action, how they are experienced by patients, carers, and staff. They're also looking at whether these services make a difference to patient care and how well stroke patients do and whether the services are good value for money. In our podcast, we want to keep our listeners updated on how Photonic is progressing and give a bit of insight on the people involved with our work. Angus, can I begin by asking you, is there anything you would like to share with us about the study since the last podcast?
Thanks, Jeremy. It's been quite a busy month. We've been working on data collection and early analysis. We're still working on our various quantitative data requests. We've also got our two conferences coming up quite soon. So Holly is going to be presenting some of our findings at the Health Services Research UK conference in Birmingham and the 999 Emergency Medical Services conference in Manchester. So we're really excited about those things. I guess that's where we're up to at the moment.
Well, that's very encouraging news, Angus. I'd like to begin by asking Angus, at what point did you begin talks with the ambulance service? What did you think they would say when you approached them with this idea?
Thanks, Jeremy. As you'll remember, we spoke with Claire Hall from the South East Coast Ambulance Service a few weeks ago. And we talked a bit about how we work together with stroke and ambulance services in developing this work. I guess thinking about the particular London case and sort of getting more into the details of that, we were approached right at the beginning of the pandemic, really, as it hit across the UK. We were approached by initially by stroke clinicians whom we knew in the London and Kent areas, who were working closely with their local ambulance services to put together these pre-hospital video triage systems in response to concerns about the safety of the system and ensuring that stroke patients are getting to the right services. So it was really from very, very early on, it was seen as essential that we be working with both the local stroke teams and the local ambulance services. So I guess in a roundabout way, I'm just sort of saying, you know, we didn't approach them. It was much more of a mutual thing, and it was kind of essential that we worked with the ambulance services from the beginning.
A very collaborative approach. Were there any potential problems you needed to resolve before formally bringing them on board or before formally you came on board?
I guess, we didn't have any particular problems. There were certain processes that you have to go through when setting up a service evaluation of the kind that we did initially with North Central London and East Kent. We sort of had a lot of meetings to work out what the issues were, how we might conduct some evaluation work around these interventions. And then we worked quite closely together in developing an evaluation protocol. So agreeing the relevant questions, identifying the types of data that we might be able to capture realistically given the pressures the system was under at the time, and then signing off the ways in which we might be able to share learning. I guess One thing that allies that links to that is some really interesting work that we did with Patrick and his team in developing a survey of ambulance clinicians. So this was a suggestion that came from the ambulance services that we should try to find out on a much broader scale how ambulance clinicians were finding working with this new way of interacting with stroke services. And so there was sort of an additional process to develop a whole online survey tool and then work out how best to distribute it. And that was a very collaborative exercise sort of during the sort of late months of 2020 and the beginning of 2021.
You used a technical term there that some of our listeners might not be familiar with, service evaluation. Can you explain the difference between service evaluation and primary research?
I mean, basically, a service evaluation is where one is more collecting data to find out how a service is operating, and generally won't involve capturing more sensitive types of data. So, for example, rather than we weren't able to conduct interviews with patients as part of something that had been classified as a service evaluation. We were conducting short, targeted staff interviews. Similarly, we used sort of publicly available stroke audit data. So for the published aggregated data covering how services were operating, rather than making a full request for patient level data from the national audit team. So it's generally not getting into the more sensitive aspects of what one might look at through fully conducted research. It's still conducted with the same rigor and care, but one is working with predominantly with lower risk elements.
Oh, thank you. There are all sorts of different online video platforms. How did you negotiate the tricky question of which platform to use?
Do you mean in terms of for the actual pre-hospital video triage process? Well, that certainly wasn't my decision. So I will hand over to Patrick to deal with this one.
Patrick, what do you recommend? How did you decide which platform you wanted to use?
Hello, Jeremy. Hello, Angus. You're right. There are multiple platforms available. We went with Apple FaceTime, and the reason we went for that is because it was already on London Ambulance Service iPads. It was free, it was easy to use, and the connectivity was excellent. So it was a simple choice to start with.
That's impressive. Three cheers for Apple. Can you tell us, please, what are your initial anxieties about this idea?
Thanks, Jeremy. Interesting. The idea itself was so beautifully simple that I didn't have any anxieties about the concept and the idea. The anxieties came with the implementation and doing this new thing, which would inevitably cause change in a large organization, not only one organization, but two organizations, and having impact on multiple organizations in the area. In the context of the pandemic, and all those things combined cause a lot of anxiety. I had to connect with up to 1,000 clinicians in the London Ambulance Service and convince them that this intervention was a good thing and something that they should do. And it was a well-established process managing and assessing stroke patients, and this was something that for them would be completely new. And the other anxiety, I suppose, was because of the context of the pandemic, the traditional mechanisms of governance and the bureaucracy weren't available to me because they'd all been diverted to other tasks. So I had to do it pretty much on my own with the assistance of the stroke team. So there was a lot of work to do in order to get this off the ground. I think looking back on it now, I probably should have been more anxious than I was at the time.
I can't imagine how on earth you managed to persuade 1,000 people. I used to be a salesman, and I know how difficult it is to sell an idea. So you've done a fantastic job. If ever you decide to give up working for the ambulance service, you've got a job working for Tupperware or something.
I hadn't considered it, Jeremy, but I'll have a look. I'll put it on my LinkedIn page.
Thank you. To your knowledge, has this sort of thing, using a video call to assess patients before getting them to hospital, happened either in the UK beforehand or anywhere else in the world?
So yes, it has. Not in this way, but certainly in London, for example, we would regularly assess patients suffering from trauma shortly after the 999 call by using a video link. And that's shown to really help in choosing what resource to send to the patient. So we can see the patient in the control room and see their injuries, and then decide whether to send a paramedic or a doctor or a helicopter doctor. So it has been used before, but to my knowledge, not in the same scale as it is being done with the stroke video assessment, in that we're connecting two different professions with the patient at the same time.
Patrick, what impressions have you heard from the crews attending using this technology? I mean, how comfortable are they with the technology, and what training did they need?
Okay, so the technology we're using is actually very simple. It's an Apple iPad using Apple FaceTime. And we know that Apple is very good, as it's built for the user. So two clicks and you're connected. It's as simple as that. There are no passwords. There are no usernames. It's very simple. So when you're at the point of care and you're potentially stressed and you've got minimum mental bandwidth, you don't have to excessively complicate the procedure. In terms of training, we created a universal training package for London Ambulance Service using a video, which the clinicians watched, had an opportunity to ask questions, and then they were good to go.
Marvellous. Absolutely marvellous. I'm very impressed with the way it's all gone. Do you think this technology could be helpful in the management of cardiac arrest patients?
So that's interesting. Paramedics tend to be the best at dealing with these patients in cardiac arrest. And this is what we're trained for. We have advanced paramedics who can be dispatched to the scene. So I don't see it being I don't see it being that useful in this particular situation. Certainly, it's been used in the past, but more for research on how to improve future cardiac arrests. Yeah. I believe I'm right in saying I was the first paramedic to live stream a cardiac arrest to a consultant who was watching in a hospital. And they were able to feedback to me afterwards about my management and the language I used and my crew resource management of the scene. But I don't believe it would be particularly useful in terms of having a live interaction with the doctor whilst the arrest is ongoing.
Wow. I'm just so impressed by technology. So how has this been received generally by family members present at the time the crew turn up? I mean, are they wondering why you just don't scoop and shoot?
Interesting. So feedback from family and patients is that by introducing the consultant-led team is very reassuring. What patients and family want is for their loved one to see a specialist as soon as possible. And what we've done is we've sped that up by at least 40 minutes. They're seeing the consultant there in their room. So yes, the traditional approach to stroke is as soon as you see the symptom, very rapid assessment and get moving. What we're getting is the consultant actually in their front room with all the family, able to either provide reassurance or encourage them to hurry up and get everything together to go. Certainly, the patients who looked like they were having a stroke but weren't having a stroke were very reassured by the presence of a stroke consultant telling them, don't worry, you're going to be fine, and we're taking you to this hospital for this reason.
Patrick, what about children? How do children react to this technology? How are they involved?
Children are an interesting cohort, and they're not currently covered by this particular pathway. Stroke in children we know to be very rare, but it does still happen. We have around 400 cases of stroke in children in the UK every year. So under 16-year-olds are not covered by this pathway. What we are in the process of doing, though, is actively linking in with Great Ormond Street Hospital. And what we want to do is develop the ability to link in with a paediatric stroke specialist so that when these rare occurrences happen, we can speak to the national expert in these conditions and then transfer them to the place they need to go. At the moment, a child suffering from stroke-like symptoms will be taken to their local paediatric emergency department.
Connie, amazing. I'm reminded of a quote from another ambulance study I'm involved in that points out people join the ambulance service because they want to be driving around saving lives, not sitting in car parks. Do you think this growth in technology could do anything for staff recruitment and retention?
That's an interesting concept that I hadn't considered. I think there's something quite exciting about being part of a multidisciplinary team, not just working totally on your own, but having links in with the rest of the NHS. And this is where I see this technology really coming into its own. The fact that potentially I could speak to a specialist in the NHS and anywhere in the country to discuss the care of my patient. I do see that as a potential incentive for joining. Yes, because it's only going to improve your clinical knowledge and care. So, yes, I think that could be a recruitment incentive.
Good. Really, really good. Can I bring you in here, Angus? What lessons have you learned about involving the ambulance service that you didn't know or expect before the study began?
That's a really good question, actually. I think this is the first sort of program of research where we've been working really closely with ambulance services and ambulance clinicians as partners. And I guess, you know, one thing that I wasn't too surprised by was just how busy people in ambulance services are. They're really constantly moving. It seems like a very, very pressured sector of the health system. I guess what I was, you know, very pleasantly surprised by was just how effective ambulance clinicians are at, you know, working around that. They're very flexible, and they, you know, they're really good at sort of finding time and making time to take part in meetings, to make themselves available for interviews and so on. I guess one of the lessons that we learned from our original service evaluation was how much data you can collect quickly, in quite a short interview, and how useful that flexibility can be to one's clinical partner. So if you say, you know, we can have an interview and it'll just take 15 to 20 minutes, people can find those 15 and 20 minutes very rapidly often. It was, yeah, really, really helpful. So yeah, very busy, but very good at working with the busyness, I think. I think that was one of the main lessons that I took away from collaboration.
Marvellous. This whole project, the whole potential of this technology is absolutely amazes me. One other quote from the research that I'm involved in with the ambulance service comes from an ambulance leader who said, everybody wants progress, but nobody wants change. And I'd be interested if you have any reflections on that or even none at all.
I mean, certainly one of the most common examples that I've come across in my research over the years So one of the main things that I've looked at over the years is reorganization of services and creation of specialist centers. So for example, like the specialist stroke units in London, Manchester and other places. And a very, very common theme with that is that clinicians will invariably say, yeah, we see the value of reorganizing services and creating specialist centers, but obviously you're going to want to have one in our organization. There's always this debate around where the specialist services should go, and that's often where a lot of the disagreement starts to happen, because people do understandably feel that their services are well positioned to deliver that specialist care.
Patrick, if an ambulance leader who said to me, everybody wants progress but nobody wants change, any comments that you can make from that?
It rings very true, that comment, and it's something that I see regularly. And I think when you're working in clinical transformation, that's something you're going to come across on a daily basis. The thing about working in the health service and medicine is that change is a constant. Things are never the same. Treatments develop. And if we were still working on old ways of doing things, we'd be rolling patients with cardiac arrest over barrels to restart their hearts. So, you know, things have to change. People don't like it because things are already very complicated. There are lots of procedures. There are lots of different guidelines to refer to. So when you introduce more change into an already stretched system, it overwhelms people. That's my theory. And I think that's, if it's a medical change or it's a clinical change, that's why having senior clinical leaders is so important. You need to have a credible senior leader driving the change. And without that, it will just be perceived as a cost-cutting efficiency exercise. It needs to be related to patient care and patient outcomes.
Marvellous. One more question, Patrick. I'd just like to ask if within your profession you have a particular hero, and if so, who is it and why are they a hero?
Wow, that's a very interesting question, and I've never considered, Jeremy, so it may take me a while to come up with a coherent answer.
Okay. You
know, no, it's fine. I think I can answer it. I don't think it's a hero in the sense, you know, there's no one famous. There's no famous paramedic that everyone knows, because actually, I think as a profession we're quite humble. We get on with the job. We do what we need to do, and those are my heroes. So there are a number of paramedics that spring to mind who just have an excellent attitude towards patient care, and they have over, you know, decades dedicated themselves to the NHS. Without moaning, they just got on with it, and they shared their knowledge and their skills with students. So those are the ones that inspire me. Not so much, you know, jumping out of helicopters and performing exciting interventions on patients. Just the ones that get on with it and are humble in doing so.
I can resonate with that. I used to be a staff nurse, and I can well resonate that the heroes in my experience are those who just get on with the job, rather than shout how wonderful they are. Well, this has been all really very interesting, but it does bring us close to the end of our time now. Is there anything, Patrick or Angus, you would like to add? Patrick first.
I think it's, as I said before, you know, it's not, having a good idea isn't enough. And to get this off the ground required people. So there was innovation, but then it just required so much collaboration, negotiation, and developing relationships and developing trust. And that's where the kind of magic happened when we joined two organizations with very different specialities that had never really worked this closely before, previously working in silos and now working in this collaborative digital space. That requires relationship building. And I think that was the success of this particular project.
Golly, absolutely amazing. Very insightful. Angus, any final words?
I mean, just flowing from the point that Patrick made there, I mean, everything that we did in our service evaluation and what we're doing now in Photonic sort of confirms the importance of that sort of really engaging clinical leadership and that willingness not just to reach up and down within one silo, but reach out beyond it. I think the other reflection that I'd have is that wider potential for innovative practices and new ways of working to act to create new relationships between different sections off the healthcare services. I think that's the main thing I would take away.
Patrick, do you think this use of technology has a future for patient care, or is it too much too soon?
So I think certainly for stroke, where there are symptoms that can be assessed visually by an external specialist, I would be cautious around a sudden rollout to all other conditions, a kind of enthusiastic rollout on the basis of what we've done here. Paramedics are very good at what they do, and they need to be able to act autonomously. There is a risk that their knowledge base and skill set would decline if there is an over-reliance on secondary support. And then if the tech failed or if the specialist team were unavailable, you then have a paramedic whose skills have atrophied over time due to the reliance on external support. So I think each patient group should be assessed carefully rather than just thinking, right, every child, now you need to call a paediatrician, because actually the system wouldn't be able to cope with that. And I'm not sure if it would be sustainable for patient care.
Nothing happens without consequences, good or bad. Everything we say, everything we do, everything we think has consequences. Marvellous. Once again, thank you, Patrick and Angus. Next podcast will be along very soon. If you'd like to learn more about the study, the Photonic website has a short explainer video and a link to the detailed research plans, or you can drop Angus a line directly. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.